The House Elections Committee will come to order. We do not yet have a quorum, obviously, so we'll await any official action, but such as approval of minutes. The first bill that we're going to take up, if Representative Dean is here, is House File 491. This, members, is an informational hearing. Representative Dean has two bills up. This is an informational hearing. There will be no action taken, no vote taken on this bill. The second one, though, is there will be a vote. So, Representative Dean, is he here? He is not here yet. Okay, I thought I saw him, but apparently not. Maybe he just stepped out for a minute. Can someone find Representative Dean? Okay. Okay, while Representative Dean is catching his breath, just a reminder, members and those in the audience, Representative Dean has two bills today, the first of which is House File 491, and this will be an informational hearing. As a courtesy not only to the author, who I know feels very passionately about that, who has constituents that he is ably representing who feel equally as passionate about it, but also because it's an interesting issue and then one that either now or in the future will probably demand this committee's attention. So reasonable people can disagree, but Representative Dane, why don't you start with your bill, House File 491, understanding that we're not going to be taking a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And let me try to locate my notes. Probably not going to be able to do that. But I present to you today House File 491. And if enacted, it will allow individuals with felony convictions to vote if they are not incarcerated. So upon leaving lockup, they will have their right to vote restored. There is some bipartisan support, but I continue to work every day to try to gain more bipartisan support relative to this. Now, I have two folks that are going to come here and speak to this bill, and then at the end, I will sort of close and make my comments as well. So we'll start with Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman. Come on down.
Welcome to the committee and back to the legislature. Mr. Freeman, just introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Mike Freeman, Hennepin County Attorney, and it was my privilege to serve in the other body for 8 years, a long time ago. I appreciate the good representative bringing House File 491 before you, because this is an issue of great concern to the county attorneys and throughout the state, unanimously endorsed by the Hennepin County County Attorneys Association and virtually every local election official in the state. It also had overwhelming support from the Governor's Task Force on Election Integrity. The essence, as Representative Dana said, is at the present time, people who are found guilty of felonies cannot vote. They cannot vote not only when they are incarcerated, but when they're out on parole. Affectionately known in the business as on paper. And that causes us a lot of concern and consternation because lots of times the felons who are out, particularly on quite unsupervised parole, which means maybe reporting once a year to the parole officer, really aren't familiar or know they can't vote. So on occasion they do vote. There are also often many reports of people who individuals believe are on probation or on parole, and the questions about their voting, and it's raised. And under the present law, the county attorney must investigate each and every allegation, and we must charge all cases probable cause at the risk of losing our office. And if the previous legislators wanted to get our attention, they did. The problem is there are all sorts of allegations, and often there are very few people that we can prosecute. Let me be precise. In 2008, we received over 1,400 referrals in the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, 1,200 from one group, which after we investigated and spent the time and energy and money doing that, was really boiled down to 451 actual referrals, or about one-third. By the time we finished processing those, we could only charge 38. And we charged 38 with being felons and voting, and each one of them had been on paper, probation or parole. Of the 667,000 people who voted Hennepin County in 2008, that's 0.0057%. or 57/1,000ths of a percent. And the only reason, Mr. Chairman, I can give you that number is because my 14-year-old was able to interpret it for me. The expense to the county attorney's office and to election officials were approximately $225,000 to prosecute 38 people. And the question is this a good expenditure of governmental dollars? Secondly, there's a whole question, too, of there's this vision that there were casts of thousands of felons illegally voting that are corrupting our election system. Well, the numbers simply don't hold that up, but we are charged by the statute to investigate each one of them. Instead, we are encouraging this legislature to look at the issue as it's carried forth by the state of North Dakota and a number of others. That is, if you were found guilty of a felony while you're incarcerated, you may not vote. When you get out, even if you're on paper, you can vote. It's a simple, direct line. And this United States Supreme Court tries to give us bright lines that we can follow. That's pretty straight up. Some people have suggested to me perhaps that means that felons on paper will vote against elected officials by some grudge. I would suggest, Mr. Chairman and members, that if they have a grudge against anyone, it's the county attorney who sent them to prison in the first place. And notwithstanding that fact, the County Attorneys Association voted unanimously to support House File 491. The present system is confusing. It frankly creates a little lack of understanding of the system, which is not good. And it's really not necessary. A person who is in prison for having committed burglary or robbery really has nothing directly to do with their capacity to vote. And we think it is neater and cleaner and frankly doesn't diminish at all from the system by allowing a clear, bright line. We prosecute people who illegally vote or vote twice. We do that cleanly, and we don't have to klutz up the system, if you will, with all this. Mr. Chairman, that's in essence of my testimony. I'd, of course, be glad to answer questions.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and County Attorney Freeman, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be here with us today. I've had a chance to visit with Representative Dean and others on this, and my honor to be on the Elections Committee has brought members from your association by my office, and so I have had a chance to think about this, and I'd just like to ask you a series of questions, again, to just help me to be able to further clarify where we're going. First question that I have is, you had indicated that when someone is paroled from incarceration, they maybe have some probation and things that they need to do as well. One of the things you said that they may not know is they didn't have the right to vote at that point. How is that made known to people? And it's within the context of someone who is released knows that they have probation requirements, need to meet with a probation officer. There's certain other conditions of probation. Why would this one fall short of one of the other or a list of things that paroled individual would not be aware of or be unable to comply with?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative Driscoll, thank you for the question. Sometimes people who have been released from incarceration, or some people who have to go to incarceration, okay, are immediately placed on probation, are given a form and information told when they report. But if it is a more minor crime, it's still a felony, but a more minor crime, they may not have to report to their probation officer more than once a year. They may be told that, and they may forget it. Or as we found in Hennepin County, a lot of times the form didn't have on it that they could not vote. Okay. Now, when we went back and spent the time, energy, and money and re-put that on the form, and then Hennepin County, as a community corrections county, went and sent a letter to every person on paper saying you can't vote, and to be fair about it, sent a letter to every person who had come off paper that they could vote, we dropped the number of cases reported from the 38 I talked to you about in 2008 to merely 10 in 2010. But it still required us to review some 150 cases. And the question is, what is the government getting for its expenditure of resources? And I would suggest to you, not much.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the light you shed on this County Attorney Freeman, which would then leads me to the next question. If we had some business transactions where there's a particular item that you want to call out separately, an individual may have to sign a form or a separate acknowledgement that they understand that this is taking place or this is not taking place in the way of a disclaimer. As a part of the judicial process, is there a place for additional education and training for individuals so that they would know under the current law that they would not be able to have the right to vote because of the nature of the crime, even though they weren't in incarceration or, as you suggested, were on probation for yet a felony but still a lesser degree felony, that we would be able to say, okay, you're acknowledging, you're getting a copy of this, and the copy of it's going into your records, that we've had the conversation, that you recognize that you can't vote. And so where I'm going with this is I don't think it's that people want to say, hey, you know, I'm going to try to dupe the system. If it's they don't understand, and simply bringing some acknowledgement to that in the process, would that solve many, if not all, of our problems?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Driscoll, that's another good question. As I said, when we realized the number of claims that were being made in 2008, went back and looked at them, a lot of them were John Smith Sr., and John Smith Jr. and who could vote, or it was a confusion of names. We also found that, frankly, Hennepin County Corrections wasn't doing as good a job on their forms or advising people about this. So we've spent the time and energy and money to try to improve that, and I think we're doing better. But to be fair, I mean, voting's important to folks, and we want it to be important, and we're proud that this state leads the nation in voting percentages. And those folks who, they may have filled out a form when it started, and they may have spent, you know, 6 months or a year in Stillwater or St. Cloud, and they've come out, and because of the nature of the crime, because they were a good prisoner, they only have to report every 6 months or every year. And it's not necessarily on the checklist. You know, it's not nearly as important in terms of criminal justice provisions as have they been able to find a job. Have they, if alcohol was a problem, have they stayed off booze? Those kind of issues are kind of more important. I mean, I think the reason that legislatures, and Minnesota's not the only one, almost every state has some kind of prescription against voting by felons. We're adding the penalty. We consider voting a privilege. And if you have committed a crime against society, we're going to take that away. But I think the more appropriate place to draw the line is whether you're incarcerated or not. Not only in terms of dollar savings, but kind of reintegrate people back into society. And again, I probably feel different if we're reviewing many, many cases of election problems, which we don't, because we don't have those series of election problems. But if a person did a burglary or a robbery, there's not a kind of a direct correlation between that and taking away their right to vote. That's why we think this line, whether you're incarcerated or not, is a cleaner line. It would establish whatever lack of integrity may have come to the election system, which is why the governor's task force on election integrity adopted this by an overwhelming vote, not unanimous, but an overwhelming vote, as a way to simplify the system and to take this issue about hordes of felon voters voting away.
Representative O'Driscoll.
And Mr. Chair, feel free to cut me off whenever you feel it's appropriate to take other questions, that is. To kind of pursue the thought process that you put us on, County Attorney Freeman, when you said that an individual may only have to report to their parole officer to corrections every 6 months or every 12 months, as a normal course of process, you said they go through and they kind of do a verification, a temperature check. Would it be beneficial to include a temperature check as a reminder, remember that these are the rights that you don't currently enjoy because of the nature of your status in society and being on probation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Driscoll, certainly. If that is an item of particular concern, you know, that's what the laws are about, and that's what you all get to write. But it seems to me in that conversation with the probation officer in that time, what you really want to know is the person being law-abiding? Is that person rehabilitated themselves? Is that person found a job? Is that person following the law? Now, we certainly can add, and we do now, and the good probation officers do it. It's not, frankly, as important to them as these other items that I just listed. So it seems to me, you know, the right to vote's really important. We know that, and that's probably one of the reasons folks want to take it away from people who commit felonies. But by the time they get out, they're starting to reintegrate the society. And this is something that seems to make sense. And, you know, I had to vote for a tax bill, a tax increase when I was a senator here, and I did. It wasn't the happiest thing I did, but if I could have made that tax increase a little smaller so you wouldn't have to pay another assistant county attorney and an investigator and a secretary to look at these claims, most of which I can never charge, I would have rather voted for a little smaller tax bill.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I fully concur with your assessment. I think we've got a couple of things that are running here. One is the mandatory statutory language that you must. The other is where we put that bright line, and then how do we keep people informed on that. And I just want to change my questions to what you were just talking about before, and that is you may have people who are in a lesser degree felony or somebody who might have been paroled, and they're out in society integrating, doing what they need to do. What about individuals who, for the lack of a better term, have a relapse or a violation of probation, but it's not such that they need to go back to incarceration? Do you see anything within the guides of that would cause or would need to give cause to revisit whether someone should have the right to vote because there was any type of probation violation, even though it wouldn't require incarceration again?
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Driscoll, the language on Representative Dean's bill 1.14 says if the individual is later incarcerated for the same offense, individual's civil rights to vote is lost only during that period of incarceration. So if they go back in, they lose their right to vote again, and I agree with that. If it's something less, it's kind of a all or nothing in most cases. If you're on paper and you're called in and you missed a reporting date, they talk with you, why did you miss a reporting date? Or often if you're required to give your analysis and you barely fail one, they'll say, please don't do this again. Okay, and I'm not sure for that, if we're going to restore their right to vote, we want to take it away again. I mean, there are four states that allow you to vote when you're incarcerated. You know, I'm not sure I'd want to be the county attorney in Washington County where Stillwater and Oak Park Heights are in that kind of situation. But, you know, most of the folks come back to the district, and, you know, your own county attorney, who's a fine county attorney, I know is quite supportive of this because she has to spend a lot of money on this as well. And it's very clear from your questions that she talked with you and you listened well. Thank you very much.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, as I do have a very solid working relationship with County Attorney Kendall, and we did talk extensively. These were actually organic. I came up with most of these on my own, but I'll let her know that you think she and I think a lot alike coming from the same area of the state. And I will just have one other question, and I will certainly defer to the chair for other testifiers, or excuse me, for other members to ask questions. And again, I'm not overly familiar with the judicial process when it comes to this, and that's why I asked the question about a violation that would cause someone to go into be reincarcerated. And you pointed out that the bill in 114 to 115 talks about you would go back. And I guess I'm asking you for your experiences, your opinions as a chief prosecutor in Hennepin County, what your thoughts are. Is there a situation where someone may do something that doesn't quite cause incarceration, but maybe there shouldn't be that privilege of voting? And I'm just trying to deal with this because ever since I've been here at the legislature, this seems to be one of those perennial issues that keeps popping up, and I would like to be able to provide Minnesotans with a clear, bright line, but I'm still trying to figure out what that bright line is.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Driscoll, thank you. I mean, I think the nature of your questions are very thoughtful, and I appreciate it very much. The United States Supreme Court is always trying to find a bright line. And so law enforcement know you do this, you violate the law, you do this, you didn't. And the law enforcement, in terms of the procedures they can undertake, you know, one of the things now in Minnesota, for example, the Scales decision says that every custodial interrogation must be recorded from start to finish. It used to happen that they would ask all sorts of questions for 2 hours, get up to the answers they want, turn the recorder on. And our Minnesota Supreme Court said it's not fair. So every single one has to be done. That's a clear, bright line that we can all follow and we can all know. The clear, bright line that I'm suggesting here is when you're in, you can't vote. And if you're sent back, you can't vote. But as long as you're out, you can. And I appreciate what you're asking, a very nuanced question. I think in this area we need to be as bright-lined as we can be, because part of it is to ensure that the election process is respected by all. There's been a lot of smoke about problems in our election system, and in my view, having overseen 7 statewide elections in the largest county in the state, we have virtually no problems. I can tell you that we've had 1 double voting question in my last 6 years, and that was, if I could take 1 second, kind of amusing. It was a person who lived in one suburb who moved to the other, and he registered to vote in the new suburb and voted for every office except city council. He went back to his old community because he disliked the city council member, voted in that line in that election up against that city council member. Now, it was clever, it was also illegal, and we prosecuted. But what we do in almost all these cases is community service, and usually it's community service related to talking about elections and the fairness. So, you know, we just don't have the problems. There's been a lot of smoke about problems with all these felon voters, like there are mass hordes waiting to vote. Doing that simply isn't true. The numbers don't hold that up. Moreover, as I said before, you know, where we can save money, we ought to, because there are a lot of good things we need to spend money on. Thank you very much.
Members, there are 2 more members who have asked to speak, and I'm wondering, Representative Erdahl and Johnson, do you have questions for this testifier, or you do? Okay. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. I do. At least I think I don't think Representative Erdahl asked this question, but I lost track. Attorney General Freeman.
That's a demotion, Mr. Representative.
Yes. as a former history teacher, I'm looking at the historical evolution of this. In state history, were felons ever able to to vote when they were on probation? Is this changed? Was there a point where the law changed?
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earle, you got me. I don't know. I do know, having looked back at some of the other states, there was a kind of a period of time during the progressive era when there were a number of states that didn't allow the felons to vote, and that changed, making the distinction between incarceration and not incarceration. And I know that was Woodrow Wilson, the progressive era, expanding voting rights. I cannot tell you Minnesota's history, and I apologize, but now I'm challenged, and I'm going to have to go back and find an answer to your question, and I will do so.
Representative Erdahl?
Thank you. That's fine.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Attorney, in other committees you've classified this as the North Dakota model. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, in Minnesota, we have a huge difference in the incarceration system. In Minnesota, on average, we spend less, about $4,200 per person per population per 100,000. I believe it's for 100,000 in the population, compared to North Dakota, spends almost $14,000 per person incarcerated by population. Minnesota is number 48, so there's only 2 states that spends less, and North Dakota is number 8, one of the most expensive states for incarceration by population. You are aware that their way of incarcerating is a lot different than in Minnesota. We do this by mostly on paper, and it's just the worst people end up going to prison, or even. And in North Dakota, most of theirs, if they commit a felony, they go to prison and they spend their time with less time on paper. And once they get out, then they have their voting rights. Just limited time on paper because they've served most of their sentence. In Minnesota, most of their sentence is on paper, not in incarceration. Consider going to the North Dakota model of incarceration?
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, well, first off, that's your all's determined to make, because you make the laws, I just enforce them. I think we have a superior judicial incarceration system here. We do have one of the lowest in the country of actual incarceration in state prisons. you know, we do a good deal of our work. If it's a sentence is less than a year and a day, that's a local sentence. They go to our workhouse in Hennepin County, for example. I think keeping folks closer to the community makes some sense as well, so their families can see them even if they're incarcerated. We have a far superior system. But on this issue, I guess we can always learn something from somebody else, and there are four other states that have this distinction between, well, there's four states that have 14, I'm sorry, there's four states that have, it doesn't matter whether you're incarcerated or not, you can still vote. And there's 14 that allow this. Thank you, Representative Dean. Your research is better than mine. I just think it's a policy question, members. Where do you want to spend your money? Do you want to have us go running around having to investigate every one of these cases at the risk of losing your job? And frankly, I'm not going to lose my job. I'm going to investigate them all. And frankly, it's money that goes down the rat hole in my vision. This is a much cleaner, this is a bright line. Everybody can understand it. And since, as I said earlier, 98% of the people incarcerated, well, 99.98% of the people incarcerated are incarcerated something other than problems in elections, and yet we've decided to take away their right. I don't have a problem why they're incarcerated. There's a period of time when I think you lose all sorts of rights. But when you're starting to come back to society, when you're out on paper, it seems to me that's a better place to draw the line. But you all make that decision.
I know Representative Sanders had a question. Was it for this testifier? We have another, if you don't mind waiting, we have at least one other testifier. Mr. Stewart? Rob Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Mr. Stewart, just introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. Although, hold on for 1 second. Representative Johnson?
I had one more follow-up.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were done. For Mr. Freeman?
That is correct.
Yes, sir. Sorry.
Representative Johnson,
my apologies. Mr. Chair, attorney, the question I have is, as most of everybody in here is aware, we've had a very contentious meeting in public safety that's going to be continued tonight on gun violence and gun laws. The question I have, by giving this right to vote back to these people, is this going to be an avenue for these people to bring to court to get their civil rights back for in order to possess firearms?
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, you know, you all, when you make the laws, can change what you want to. I would oppose that. I think it's an entirely different issue. This is a question of reestablishing civil rights to vote. It's also civil right to be able to carry a weapon. And Representative Cornish, who I've had an opportunity to work with, and I'd be happy to say, even though we're on the different sides of the aisle, I consider Representative Cornish a friend. He raised that issue in a previous hearing in this House. I would oppose that. That's a kind of a different issue. This is restoring the passive act of voting. This is not gun carrying.
Representative Johnson.
Just one comment on this. I believe if we start restoring any of the rights until they're off paper and completed their sentence, it opens an avenue because we have no jurisdiction over what a judge might do. It's their prerogative in the court system.
Thank you. Why don't we go to the next testifier then? Mr. Stewart, just introduce yourself for the record and proceed. And members, just as a housekeeping matter here, I don't want to go too much beyond another 15 or so minutes since we have another bill to take up, and one for which there will be a vote.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, excuse me. My name is Robert Stewart, and I'm a PhD student at the University of Minnesota. I'm also, like tens of thousands of other Minnesotans, a felon living under community supervision since 2006, and I have been prohibited from voting. When I spoke to you a few weeks ago, it was on the felon notification bill, and it's possible that my remarks might have strayed way off topic, and I apologize for that. But with that in mind, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to speak here today about the actual topic of this bill, voting restoration, and why it's important to me. Growing up in Owatonna, I was taught from a young age about democracy and the value of voting. My parents and teachers taught me that the United States was founded on democratic principles. Perhaps the most important of these is a citizen's right to vote. I was taught that the right to vote is not just an important sacred right, but is also an essential component of a citizen's civic duty. Through voting, ordinary citizens express their concerns or choices in the way the government operates and how their tax money should be spent. It is important to also consider that voting is not just about casting a ballot for president or senator. It's also about choosing members of the local school board and voting for or against local taxes or referendum. Of course, there are people in this country who take their right to vote for granted, but I'm not one of them. I value the right to vote. And I would argue that as this state regularly leads the nation in voter turnout, Minnesotans strongly value the right to vote as well. Minnesota is also the envy of most of the country in regard to our criminal justice sentencing policies, because we have the second lowest rate of incarceration in the nation. And that is a fact that is absolutely something I believe we should be proud of. But this is largely due to a reliance on alternative sentencing measures like probation. However, the flip side of that coin is that, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, Minnesota has the seventh highest rate of citizens living under community supervision, like probation or supervised release. As probation sentences in Minnesota have gotten longer, those numbers continue to grow because the courts are regularly handing out probation sentences of 10, 20, and 30 years. According to data from the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, over the last decade, nearly 20,000 Minnesotans have been given probation sentences greater than 10 years, and more than 1,000 of those were given 30 or more years of probation. And since 1982, the percentage of the voting age population who are disenfranchised in Minnesota has grown by over 400%. In other words, this is not an insignificant number of our family members, our friends, our neighbors, and our coworkers. So imagine a 19-year-old kid who had gotten into drugs, had a run-in with the criminal justice system, and was placed on probation for 30 years. He wouldn't be able to vote until his kids have graduated from college because of the decisions he made when he was just a teenager. And I would ask, exactly what purpose does that serve? This example is not unlike my own. I got into drugs when I was in high school, and I was in my 20s when I was first arrested in 2005, but my sentence will be completed in a few years from now. I made a number of bad decisions as a young person, but since my own felony conviction, I've worked very hard to turn my life around. I earned my bachelor's degree from the University of Minnesota, graduating summa cum laude with high distinction, and I'm currently working on my PhD. I volunteer often. I speak to kids who are on probation, juvenile detention centers, and in treatment centers, telling them my story in the hope that my experience can help guide them away from the same consequences I went through. Along with graduate school, I also work at the university and have had a job since getting out of jail several years ago. I contribute to the economy. I pay taxes, but I'm not allowed to have a say in how that tax money is spent. I want to participate positively and meaningfully in my community as a full citizen of the community, but not being allowed to vote makes that impossible. As each election approaches, I am forced to watch from the sidelines. As conversations become centered around candidates people are voting for and the issues we all care about, I am forced to admit that I am not allowed to vote. A recurring reminder of my past mistakes. It's tough, and it's demoralizing, sitting home on election day, especially when each election can mean so much. I would also like to submit that I am not alone in my desire to vote. Many friends and acquaintances in similar situations as I am also feel the same way. We have made our mistakes in the past, but now many of us are positive and productive citizens, and we would just like to be full members of our communities, not second-class citizens. I would respectfully request that the committee takes a moment to consider why we use disenfranchisement as a form of punishment. Our legal system recognizes a substantive difference between imprisonment and probation. While imprisonment is characterized as incapacitation and separation from society, probation or other forms of supervised release are, just as the name suggests, a probationary period where a person is subject to restrictions and requirements that seek to promote a pro-social behavior in society. So I'd ask, however, what could be more pro-social than an individual choosing to exercise his or her right to vote? In my opinion, choosing to vote is a clear signal that a person has a vested interest in his or her community and the future of his or her community. In fact, current criminological research, which I would be happy to submit for the record, has shown that voting appears to be a part of a package of pro-social behaviors. It's a symbolic form of community membership, and it discourages and decreases recidivism while aiding in the reintegration of individuals into positive, productive roles in the community. And the best part is that it's free. So it comes at no cost and no risk to public safety. So Mr. Chair, representatives, as I previously stated, tens of thousands of Minnesotans are living in our communities and are disenfranchised. And that number grows every day. I thank you again for the opportunity to explain why voting and voter restoration is important to me. And I ask that you consider why we disenfranchise in the first place. And I urge you to consider voter restoration as a way to encourage reintegration and civic membership for our fellow Minnesotans. So I hope the members of this committee and your colleagues will take a serious look at felon reenfranchisement and the positive impact that it could have. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Stewart. Any questions for this particular testifier? Okay, if not, I wanted to go back to Representative Sanders, who I know had... No? Okay, he's going to pass. Members, I don't know, Representative Dean, if you wanted to say anything, but I do want to just see if there's anyone else in the remaining minutes, and I want them to be a few remaining minutes. Anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Understand that there won't be a vote today. This is an informational hearing. Anyone in the audience who wishes to testify? Okay, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you again for the hearing today. Currently, we have 13 states, along with the District of Columbia, that have a model that's in line with the North Dakota model. So North Dakota is not the only state. There are many other states. The testifier spoke to what I would say are two very different aspects. One is about what a county attorney deals with every day or every year relative to these elections. And Mr. Stewart spoke to the issue of how he is personally infected and how it affects the community. We have over 45,000 people in Minnesota, I believe, that are under supervision, and these individuals do not have a right to vote. I contended last week in public safety hearing that I do not believe that removing a person's right to vote is something that keeps them on the straight and narrow. But I actually do believe that telling an individual that they're an important part of society, that we want them to be positive contributors, I believe that voting does have an impact on that. So I would contend that telling an individual that you are now released, we want you out in society, we want you to be a positive citizen, and you have the right to vote, does have an impact. Currently, our system, criminal justice system, impacts disproportionately people of color and minority communities. So in many ways, this is a disenfranchisement de facto of those individuals in those communities. I've been fighting long for quite some time on issues related to those who have been disenfranchised due to criminal convictions. Many of you know that 36 years ago, I was convicted of a burglary. And to be quite honest, I look forward to that day that when I was able to vote. Believe me, not having the right to vote didn't keep me from not committing another offense. There are many other factors that played into that. But the day that I was able to vote, I felt whole again in society. And I think that that's the case for many individuals. County Attorney Freeman can speak about the financial costs relative around this, but I think there's a larger cost that impacts all of us, and that is making our community safer. And I believe that allowing individuals to actively participate in our election system makes us all safer in the end. I could go on for another 5 minutes, but I have another bill that's about to come up. I want to thank you again for this hearing, and I would be more than happy to chat with any individual about this particular bill, because I believe it's a good bill, and I believe it's the direction that we need to be moving as a state.
Thank you, Representative Dean, and thanks, members, for your patience here, because this was an informational hearing. I know it means a lot to Representative Dean. I know that he's going to try to continue to make this bipartisan, which, of course, is a prerequisite for any bill like this being signed, so I'm sure that will be his mission over the next year or so. Thank you, Representative Dean. We'll now just transition then to your next bill, which is really a resolution, not a bill, as I understand it, House File 276. So this would not require a gubernatorial signature. This would be, as I understand it, it's been a while since we've done resolutions. I think that's right. It would just be a resolution that would be voted out of presumably the House and Senate floor if it got that far, and so it wouldn't require any gubernatorial action. Representative, go ahead to your bill, House File 276. Before we do that, just to some housekeeping, Representative Halverson, have you had a chance to look at the minutes of Thursday, March 17th?
Mr. Chair, I have reviewed the minutes, and I would move the approval of the minutes from March 14th.
Okay. March 14th. Thursday, March 14th minutes. Representative Halverson moves approval of the minutes of March 14th, 2013. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. Does someone want to move House File 276? Representative Mariani moves that House File 276 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. That's the motion. Representative Dean, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The bill before you, House File 276, is a joint resolution to Congress that would call on Congress to propose an amendment to the Constitution that would impact issues around elections as well as issues around corporate personhood. It states that the rights protected by the Constitution are the rights of natural persons only, not of artificial entities. And of course, artificial entities not only include corporations, but associations, organizations, nonprofits, and unions as well. This bill and this resolution states that federal, state, and local governments shall regulate, limit, or prohibit contributions and expenditures, including a candidate's own contribution and expenditure, and that the judiciary shall not construe the spending of money to influence elections to be speech under the First Amendment. And again, there's nothing in this bill that construes to abridge the freedom of the press. In addition, this bill calls on Congress to, should they not act, to call a constitutional convention. And, you know, I don't think there's any of us here that want a constitutional convention. But if two-thirds of the state pass similar language, it would actually tell Congress that we're very serious about this and allow them the opportunity then to, of course, move forward with a constitutional amendment. So we're hoping that you'll all support this particular joint resolution. We'll send the letter to Congress, as this is instructing us to do. And I do have one testifier here, and I would like to turn it over to him to speak directly to some of the larger issues around this.
Okay. Welcome, sir. Introduce yourself to the record, please, and proceed.
Thank you, Committee Chair Simon. And other members of the House Elections Committee. My name is Robin Monahan. My testimony is on behalf of Senate File 276, and I am speaking in concert with Move to Amend, a national coalition of many small organizations, with the idea of promoting a U.S. constitutional amendment to the national constitution to get big money out of politics and correct the U.S. Supreme Court's decision on Citizens United. It's about corporations are not people, and money is not speech. I am a Minnesota volunteer for Move to Amend. I was born in Minnesota and educated in Minnesota public schools. In 1964, I enlisted in the U.S. Navy and took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. From April of 67 to April of 68, I served with the U.S. Marine Division as a Navy hospital corpsman. In 1973, I graduated from St. Scholastica with a degree in nursing and retired from nursing in 1998. I'm also a partner in a small Minnesota business that I helped start 29 years ago. In January of 2010, I awoke from a comfortable retirement slumber when I heard that the U.S. Supreme Court, in its Citizens United versus Federal Elections Commission, granted constitutional rights and the status of persons to corporations. At that point, I asked myself this question. Do corporations need constitutional rights and more influence on our elections and electoral process and legislative process? My answer, based on working in healthcare and a small business, was absolutely not. I was outraged by the Citizens United decision of the Supreme Court, but being politically inert for 67 years, I didn't know quite what to do. But I agreed with my brother that we would walk across the United States to raise people awareness of how the Citizens United decision degrades and harms the democratic process. From mid-May of 2010 until late October, my brother and I did walk from the Pacific to the Atlantic, and we had thousands of conversations with real persons about this issue, and 99% or more agreed that democracy is worth striving for and that the Citizens United decision needs to be corrected. We didn't talk with any corporations. Corporations don't have conversations. Corporations aren't people. Money is not speech. The language of House File 276 is to help move we the people back on the road toward democracy by reserving constitutional rights for natural persons and by making elections fair where a natural person's vote and voice is important and not smothered into irrelevance by millions of dollars dropped into our elections by anonymous sources. We the people want the influence of big money out of politics and to end corporate rule. Because of Supreme Court decisions, we need a constitutional amendment. A constitutional amendment is an ambitious goal. Previous amendments that corrected Supreme Court decisions included the 13th and 14th Amendment that corrected the Dred Scott decision, and the 19th Amendment, women's suffrage, corrected the Minor versus Hepperstedt, a Supreme Court decision denying women the right to vote. Those were ambitious goals, and yet when we look back on those historic amendments, those were what looks obvious today. First, the necessity to correct social injustice, and second, the inevitability of the passage of these amendments on the road toward democracy. You and I both took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution. Now you have an opportunity to be remembered in history for upholding and defending by correcting injustice with the promotion of this bill forward. House File 276 is a nonpartisan bill, having broad popular support for getting big money out of politics and ending corporate rule, and allowing we the people, all natural persons, to keep moving toward democracy. Please support House File 276 on its merits and encourage its passage through the House of Representatives. In summary, corporations are not people, and money is not speech.
Thank you, Mr. Monahan. Are any member questions for Mr. Monahan? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Monahan, you didn't do any running along the way, did you? Just walking?
A little bit of running.
Okay. Representative Dean, I don't know who you both of you answer, whichever. But I just want to be clear on some things. You know, natural persons voting or contributing. Is there any limit to how much can be contributed?
Representative Dean, or Ramani?
Within the joint resolution, it allows, you know, federal, state, and local governments to regulate, limit, and prohibit those contributions and expenditures. So, you know, that would be up to the states, federal governments, and local jurisdictions as well.
Representative Riddle.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Dean, would this this then would restrict all, you know, soft money, the contributions that, well, that come in unbeknownst to the candidates? Is that the intent of this?
You know,
Representative Dean.
Yes. You know, this is to add that transparency. You know, states, local governments, and the federal government can set up those issues where an individual has to be named, the source of money have to be included, and those types of things. So, yes, the intent is to stop unfettered, unknown money into the election system.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Dean, so I'll just give a real specific example, and I think that I know where you're coming on this, but you know, I know of, you know, legislative campaigns in this last cycle where between the Democrat and the Republican candidates, they're like $500,000 just in direct mail pieces that neither candidate may have had any direct knowledge was happening. Would this prohibit those types of things?
Representative Dean.
But, you know, I'm not so sure if it prohibits it specifically, because the states themselves would have to then implement those types of regulations. But again, I think you raise an important issue. But the joint resolution is really targeted to Congress to, in many ways, address the issues that have come up as a result of Citizens United ruling.
Representative Mr. Chairman, Representative Dean, well, no, to me that's a very important issue to address. And then you know, Mr. Monahan mentioned several times corporations. And, you know, I just wanted, you know, I know you referenced it earlier, but I just wanted to be very plain that you are also talking about restricting labor unions.
Representative Dean.
Yes, I believe it's very clear that, you know, the privileges, you know, for corporations, unions, and other folks are determined, you know, through federal, state, and local laws.
All right, thank you.
Any other member questions for this testifier? Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if Representative Erdahl asked this question or not, but I'll go ahead. Representative Dean or Mr. Monahan, you referenced, Mr. Monahan, the Supreme Court decision of January of 2010. Is your thoughts or intentions that would roll it back to the pre-Supreme Court ruling, or would it go further back with all types of organizations, associations that may have existed prior to 2010 that might have had those kinds of privileges?
Mr. Monahan or Representative Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Monahan.
And Representative O'Driscoll. The intent of Bill House File 276 is quite clear that only natural persons would have constitutional rights. So this would go back far before Citizens United. Also, it refers to taking reversing, actually, the Buckley versus Vallejo, which was back in 76, that equates money to speech. So it would be overturning or correcting that Supreme Court decision as well. So yes, it does go well before Citizens United.
Okay. Any other? Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dean, perhaps even Mr. Gehring, just looking for some definitions here. Line 1.20, is this already defined in statute, an artificial entity? And then at the end of that line, other entities. What exactly is an artificial entity, and what is defined by other entities?
Before we go to Mr. Gehring, do you have a thought about that? Representative Dean is the author.
Well, yeah, I again, it goes back to, you know, the difference between a natural person and a not natural person, if there is such a thing. So I think other entities would encompass, as I mentioned, organizations as well as nonprofits, unions, other groups. I mean, these are businesses or entities that are given authority to either participate in business through our laws. So this resolution is speaking directly to the issue of the rights of natural-born persons.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then just to clarify or drill down even farther, would this resolution, if so acted and Congress took it up and there was an amendment passed, would this, if all of that happened, would that ban money from political action committees, any organization? So basically the only source of income for any campaign would be from a private individual citizen. I want to get at exactly what this is doing in specific terms, especially if we have the potential for a constitutional convention on the hook in here.
Representative Dean.
You know, I don't believe that it totally prohibits all money from being able to be contributed into campaigns. What this does is it does begin to address the issue of corporate entities having the ability, as well as non-transparent contributions into our elections. So again, I think what this does is it still allows the ability of the federal government, state government, and local governments to regulate and limit what those particular contributions could be.
Representative Sanders.
Mr. Chair, I just want to be sure. And I know we talked about this, Representative Dean. I believe you have the purest of intentions here, but I just really want to understand this. I don't know if Mr. Gehring can help again, but I've heard you use the phrase, you know, this is going to define, you know, basically who a natural person is and what rights then are protected under the Constitution. But then it seems I'm looking then for that relationship and what the federal, state, and local entities could prescribe then as far as campaign spending goes. And I don't know if Mr. Gehring can, again, start with how we define an artificial entity or other entity, and then maybe we can start with that.
Mr. Gehring, can you shed any light on the phrase artificial entity, or is that just a matter of the drafting done in this proposed language? Is it connected with Minnesota law or any definition that you know of?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sanders, so this language that's in the resolution was proposed language that would be in the U.S. Constitution. So if enacted, it would be subject to interpretation by the courts. I mean, presumably, state law could enact definitions or enact regulations as allowed, and a court would have to interpret whether the regulations are appropriately tied to artificial entities as would be required under the constitutional language. So there's not a specific definition in this bill or in law that I know of, and because this is amending the U.S. Constitution, this would trump any existing laws that are in place currently.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just a word of caution in my opinion, with you know, the mechanics of this resolution, especially when you have, you know, the application for calling up a constitutional convention. I know that you said for the purpose of amending the language that's substantially similar or similar to this, but it's my understanding, and I could be wrong, and I'm open to being corrected, but I think once a constitutional convention is called, everything's on the table. Whether or not this makes it there, I think if we're going to go down that road, we better have crystal clear language defined here, especially if you want, in theory, if Congress doesn't take this up, and even if they do, these definitions appear to be open to interpretation, which could end you up in a situation that, again, you don't like, potentially, if courts are defining what these terms mean. So I'll just kind of leave it at that for now.
Representative Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we've talked about the idea of what is an artificial entity and who might and organizations and kind of some terms. I guess I'd like to just maybe cite a few examples and maybe ask the testifier and the author of the bill to maybe react as to whether or not they would believe that those would be the kinds of organizations that would be included or excluded or regulated in some different way. In the state of Minnesota, we have a political party, the Independence Party. That's a group of people who have like-minded. They're an incorporated entity. People make contributions to them to support candidates that are of like mind with them. Would they be included, excluded, or how would they be treated under the proposed resolution and constitutional amendment?
Representative Dean or Mr. Monahan? Representative Dean.
You know, I don't know that we would treat the Independence Party any different from how we treat the Republican Party or how we treat differently the DFL Party. Again, we have rules and regulations regarding them currently. And I don't believe that this does away with their ability to operate as parties.
Representative Driscoll.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. They are incorporated as entities that would be artificial persons that do have money. And so based on some of the testimony that we've heard and kind of surrounding this, I'm wondering if they would be considered an artificial person that has money. That would not be speech. Again, it's individuals who have a like mind, whether it be the Minnesota Republican Party, the DFL Party of Minnesota, the Independence Party, the list would go on, or other voluntary associations, labor unions that might have wings of or divisions that may advance political causes, support candidates and things. That's not a person. That's a group of like-minded people getting together to promote an agenda. The Chamber of Commerce in the state of Minnesota, business owners who have like mind and pay an association fee, where they may also have a wing or a division that would promote, support candidates and causes of those. I guess I'm just trying to get a scope on, we can talk entities, we can talk things, maybe it's just easier to talk about who might and who might not, I hate to say by name, but at least getting some kind of idea of what style of organization might or might not be included.
Right. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll, if you look at 2.1, it says the privileges of these, of artificial entities shall be determined by the people through federal, state, and local laws. So, I mean, to me, that's fairly clear. That ultimately they don't have these rights based on the Constitution. They have these privileges that are based on the laws of the federal, state, and local laws.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Isn't that what we currently have, that these are regulated under federal, state, and local laws?
Actually, Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll, I believe that Citizens United has pretty much completely opened things up, that there is no, I mean, technically, the issue of big money and individuals can now make contributions such that there's virtually no tracking of how that money is influencing our elections and contributing to these elections. Individual or a corporation can make a substantial contribution to a particular another organization without any reporting of what that initial contribution was.
Representative Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, I'll assure you it's not my time to, or my goal to run the entire committee time on asking questions on this, but I will make this my last question, and Representative Dean's comment really just kind of brought this together in my mind. What about if we take away artificial entities and we say an individual may have means to which they can influence by contribution to candidates or causes and things in their own name versus those individuals who are of less means who want to organize together to be able to share their common message and get on the same playing field with those who are individuals? How are we going to be able to have those work in concert with one another when my $25 contribution may not make pale in comparison to your individual $100,000 contribution as an individual that might be made? Because if it's regulated under state and federal laws, we have some in Minnesota that could be changed under our campaign finance laws here as well.
Representative Dean.
Well, I think to your point, and I wish I had $100,000 to contribute to a campaign. To your point, Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll, if the state decides that an individual can make a $100,000 contribution, they can do that. If the state decides that an individual can make a $500 contribution, they can do that. If the state decides that it's only a $25,000 contribution, they can do that. What this does is it allows the states to define what that is.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, Representative Dean pretty much said what I wanted to say in response to the queries. I do think I am struck as I'm sitting here listening about the sort of the absurdity that's kind of been created by extending a constitutional right to a non-living entity that then requires us to do precisely what Representative Saunders is cautioning us to do, which is to be very clear and precise about how we would choose to extricate ourselves, from the principles being advanced now by, and steadily over the years by the Supreme Court in this area. I'm obviously challenged to do that, but I think it is the right thing for us to do. But our task has just gotten a little bit more difficult, Representative Dean, in terms of, getting back to what I think is a much more commonsensical application of the spirit of our Constitution, which I personally don't believe was meant to cover the kind of possibilities that are now being offered by Citizens United. Nonetheless, I am challenged by, the need to listen to Representative Saunders' advice in terms of, well, then, given that we do have, Supreme Court decision, how do we carefully extricate ourselves, through legislative action? I loved your answers in terms of, the sky isn't going to fall here. The point is that legislative elected bodies of the people can extend rights to non-living entities or whatever we call them, as we're careful here. That's the whole point of the legislative process. And obviously, prior to this decision, even the ones before, we were steadily extending those kind of rights, but they were consciously decided by elected officials of the people and not asserted as flowing automatically from, the core assumptions of our U.S. Constitution. And so I do struggle with the kind of language here. I support the intent and the spirit and the purpose, and I think we'll be smart enough to figure out good technical language here. Whether this is it or not, I don't know. But I am supportive of your effort.
Members, I just want to see if there are no member questions immediately or pending. I wanted to see if there was anyone else in the audience that wishes to be heard on this bill. This resolution. Just introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Jeremy Schrader. I am the executive director of Common Cause Minnesota. We're a nonpartisan government watchdog group. I'm here today to express our strong support for House File 276 to overturn the Supreme Court ruling in Citizens United. Most troubling with the Citizens United decision is that it removes any limits to campaign spending from sources outside of the candidate campaign, most notably super PACs. This decision is having devastating effects on the ability of regular citizens to have their voice heard. A couple examples from the 2012 elections. Nearly 60% of super PAC funding came from just 157 donors contributing at least $1 million. More than 93% of the money to super PACs, the super PACs raised, came from contributions of at least $10,000 from 3,318 donors, or the equivalent of 0.0011% of the U.S. population. This 0.011 of a percent of people in the U.S. decide basically all of our public policy from, our spending for military, public safety, and healthcare. The top 32 super PAC donors give an average of $9.9 million each. that amount matched the $3.3 million that President Obama and Governor Romney raised from all of their small donors combined. And that's at least 3.7 million people giving at least $200. Every elected official and every aspiring politician who hopes to hold office must now think about the financial impact of his or her position on virtually every issue. A vote cast in support of a big contributor's position may guarantee the official will have more than enough money to ensure re-election. A wrong vote could trigger the financing of a crippling campaign of negative ads. Finally, House File 276 addresses an issue that affects both parties. The power of big money undermines the ability of all candidates and elected officials to act on their conscience, to not have to worry as much about the expense of running a campaign, and affects the ability to do the people's work. House File 276 solves these problems by calling on Congress to put forth a constitutional amendment to nullify the Citizens United ruling. This will stop the unlimited spending allowed by corporations and labor unions and restore the people's voice to our democracy. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak, and I urge you to vote yes on House File 276.
Thank you, Mr. Schrader. Any member questions for this testifier? Okay. Anyone else? Thank you, Mr. Schrader. Anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on this? Okay, members, just a note of explanation. Because this is a resolution, and for some of the newer members, you may not realize this, if this were to go to the House floor, this is different from a regular bill. Obviously, it doesn't require any gubernatorial action of any kind. But also, the unique thing about that is no member need vote on a resolution. Now, it's true with the bill that no member need vote. You can stay off the board, but then you're marked as having not voted explicitly in the journal. With a resolution, if it goes to the floor, you cannot vote, and there's no marking whatever kind. It just talks about who voted yes, who voted no, and there's no status for anyone who is there but chooses not to vote. I've done that in the past myself on resolutions for one reason or another, just consciously and purposely not voted on a resolution. So this is a little bit of a different creature. It is going to civil law next. It's the committee on which I sit. I'm looking forward to the talk about the First Amendment issues. I feel the need to say, Representative Dane, I will, out of courtesy to you and because it's an interesting and important issue, I'll be voting yes to move this along. But as you and I have talked about, I just have some real reservations along the lines of what Representative Sanders said. You know, and I don't want to dredge up old history here, but the last session of the legislature, there were some constitutional issues, and I and others took the position that we shouldn't amend constitutions unless absolutely necessary. I'm not trying to get back into the substance of those issues. And there are a lot of Supreme Court decisions with which we all take issue. There are pro-life members, people we like and trust and know in this body of both parties, who would love to revisit and call a constitutional convention on Roe versus Wade, for example, or gun control advocates who are disappointed with the Heller decision. The list goes on. And I understand this is only a resolution. It's just urging Congress to do something. I also understand that the constitutional convention is a last resort. It's incredibly unlikely that it were to happen. Still, as a matter of principle, I'm reluctant to do something that we haven't done since the late 1700s. And to even call for it is something that I'm not sure I'm yet willing to do, just me personally. Mm-hmm. And so I just want the record to reflect that I will vote today to move this along because it's an interesting discussion. But I think it's a very, very big step. And I know it's one that you take seriously. I'm not implying that you aren't conscious of what a big step it is. I know you do, and you take it seriously, and you're a passionate advocate for the bill. I'm just saying that my own position, and I feel some obligation as chair of this commission committee to flesh it out, is that as passionately as you or I or others may disagree with the Citizens United case, and for the record, I did think it was wrongly decided in the sense that it tossed out about 100 years worth of precedent. But there are other Supreme Court decisions that I might disagree with and outcomes I might disagree with. Representative Sanders might have a different set of Supreme Court decisions he disagrees with and others here who we know and trust and like. And I'm wary of setting the precedent that when we disagree with the Supreme Court decision interpreting the U.S. Constitution that we create kind of a reflex of calling to open up the entire document for the first time in 200-plus years. Though I understand it's only a resolution, it's non-binding, and I also understand it's the secondary request, not the first request. I just felt the need to say that. So any other member comments or questions? Representative Mariano.
Sir, just a curiosity question. I wasn't aware of the voting parameters in this on the floor. Does that So if enough members don't vote, does the resolution still require the 68 votes on the floor of the House to be a successful,
good question,
successfully moved?
I confess, Representative Mariani, I'm not sure about that.
Okay,
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. Mr. Guerin, do you know that? I don't know. We'd have to consult House rules. I don't know. That's a fair and good question. Any other member comments, questions, concerns? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Mariani renews his motion that House File 276 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Civil Law. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, members. At this point, we've already moved the minutes. Members, we have nothing yet.
Mr.
on the
Chair?
Yes.
Did you say the motion fails?
I'm sorry, prevails.
Prevails.
Prevails. Prevails. Your bill is on its way to civil law. It prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
For the record. Thank you, Representative Dean. Oh, Representative Huntley.
Well, I don't know. We don't do personal privilege in committees, but I have a comment, if I could, for Mr. Monahan, who did you say you were from Duluth?
I have lived in...
Mr. Monahan.
I graduated high school, International Falls, graduated from St. Scholastic and Duluth. I have lived in Duluth for 12 years, but now I'm a resident of Shoreview, north of St. Paul.
Okay. Well, I was going to point out that I always call this the Duluth Room. If you look at all these etchings around here, they're all City of Duluth, and they're from the Works Progress Administration back in the 30s, when we had the Great Depression, and the government paid artists to do their work.
I did not know that, Representative Huntley. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Monahan. Members, we have nothing scheduled at this point for Thursday. I don't know of any bill that made Senate deadline that would require our action, but I'll reserve the right to call a meeting. There are a couple things we might take up, but as of now, there is no agenda. But obviously, stay tuned to your email, and I want to be respectful of everyone's time. I think that's it. Members, unless there are any other comments, the committee is adjourned.